And now for a little science versus fiction sidebar. I am here with one of the planet's leading experts on 1982's Blade Runner, Charles de la Zurica. And Charles, give us a background with this film.
I mean, it goes all the way back to when my mom took me and some friends, because the film was rated R, to the Mann Hollywood Theater on opening day, June 25th, 1982. And just going in expecting, you know, as it was advertised, the new film from the director of Alien with the star of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and watching the film and not getting anything close to that. It was a very different animal, that film, and it intrigued me. I mean, I watched that film, you know, multiple times that summer of 82, and many, many times on home video. And that's kind of when my like fascination with the film started to really blossom, because I started to notice that in the packaging for the VHS, it said, contains additional moments of violence and additional footage. And that right there was interesting, because it was like, oh, there's a second version now of Blade Runner. And just beyond being in love with the world that had been created, and the details of the design and the visual effects, and even the fantastic score by Vangelis and the incredible cast and everything that was great about Blade Runner, there was this new mystique kind of forming around it in regards to multiple versions of the film, which then continued on into like 1991, when a 70 millimeter print of the work print of Blade Runner, which is the version that had been pretty much test screened for audiences before its release, had somehow gotten out. And the somehow was that there was a 70 millimeter film festival at the Fairfax Theater. And they requested of Warner Brothers a 70 millimeter print of the film. And the person at Warner Brothers, Michael Eric, was the one who basically found that can with the 70 millimeter print in it and sent it off. And people who get up, you know, early in the morning to watch Blade Runner at a 70 millimeter, you know, festival are obviously mega fans. So once the film began and you immediately see the Ladd Company logo with a white background instead of a black background, people are like, oh, that's different. That's interesting. And then the credits, the opening credits, are totally different. And there's a different dictionary definition of what a replicant is. And it's just right off the bat, it's already a very different version of the film. And that continued on for big chunks of that version, which included a lot of different music in the third act, which was all temp score. You know, a lot of it came from Jerry Goldsmith's Planet of the Apes and James Horner's Humanoids from the Deep and the movie The Hand, I believe. And also there's some Brian Eno music in there that he kind of had banned himself. He had self-banned a cue called Quran because of some of the religious controversy that came out of that. So anyway, that right there was a third known version of the film, and people freaked out, and suddenly Warner Brothers realized, oh, we should probably release this and make some money off of it. And so they did, and they screened it at the New Art in West LA to sold out crowds, and they extended the run, and you know, it was just a phenomenon. And then it went to San Francisco at the Castro Theater, same reaction. Everyone was just amazed. There's this lost version of Blade Runner. And this is off, obviously, after the word had gotten out that the film had a troubled production, that Ridley Scott's vision had been compromised by the financiers and other elements. So there's this notion brewing that, oh, this is the lost cut of Blade Runner that we were all meant to see. And of course, Ridley Scott had issues with that, because it wasn't. It was just an early version of the film that was different enough for fans to flip out over, but it wasn't his true director's cut. So,
and yet called it the director's cut, correct?
That's right. And that was a big problem, because it wasn't. So, you know, he and Warner Brothers started talking, and they thought, okay, well, let's do a true director's cut. The problem is Ridley was in the middle of making, it was either Thelma and Louise or 1492, but it was around that time, and he couldn't, you know, put all of his attention on it. So he basically said, look, at minimum, I want the voiceover removed. I want the happy ending, which was, you know, mostly outtakes from The Shining, taken off. And I want the inclusion of this unicorn dream. So Warners and Michael Eric, they set out to try to make that happen. Unfortunately, they only found an outtake of the unicorn, not the true cut of it that they originally intended. So what you got with that 1992 director's cut was a sort of almost kind of director's cut. It wasn't really Ridley's true vision, but, you know, he wasn't hands-on involved, but he allowed it to happen because it was, you know, kind of getting in the ballpark of what he wanted.
Right. So if you include the network television version, that's technically the sixth version, released version of Blade Runner.
I mean, I guess. So we've got the work print. Yeah. We've got the U.S. theatrical. We've got the international cut, which is what that first sort of like extra violent version was. We've got the 92 director's cut. So that's four versions right there. TV version, you can call it another version. I wouldn't exactly.
What other films would we do that? Would you call the TV version of Scarface an alternate cut? Not really.
I mean, some people do, because sometimes you get some crazy TV version like John Carpenter's The Thing that has narration in the opening and whatever. Mm-hmm. So there are certain TV cuts that I think are worth calling another version, but Blade Runner is probably
fair enough.
But all this led to the notion that, okay, so at some point, let's do the true, definitive, Ridley Scott approved final cut of the film. And we started talking about it around the year 2000, 2001, and we started working with Warner Brothers trying to identify what that version would be and where those elements that we would need, you know, where they were. And it was a long, long process. And Warner's had some of the elements, but not all. And most of the kind of like the original negative and the original kind of uncut footage and trims and everything we really needed to explore was in a warehouse and basically archived for Jerry Parenchio, who was one of the financiers. And, you know, he was a kind of a very, you know, firm-handed businessman who, you know, he really only cared about the money and the deal and didn't have a lot of bandwidth or interest in the artistic creative side of it or the historical side at this point, because it was becoming like a bit of film history that was unfolding. But eventually they made a deal, and, you know, it took years, but finally around 2005, 2006, we really started getting into, okay, what is this final cut going to be? And let's begin exploring what we have to work with. And because we finally got Jerry Parenchio's permission, we were able to go in and look at all the footage, all the raw dailies, like everything that existed. I believe it was 997 boxes of film that we went through.
Wow. Back up just a bit and explain to our listeners how you got involved specifically in DVD production and
oh God. I'm sorry, that's such a long story.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's all fascinating minutia for fans of the movie. Absolutely.
Well, the fast version is I was an intern from USC working with Ridley and Tony Scott, and I was doing a lot of kind of like odd jobs around the office, and that included like reading scripts and just whatever. I was just like a lackey that was happily doing whatever they wanted. And around 98, I mentioned to Ridley that Fox was going to work on the Alien set, the first Alien box set for DVD, which was a new thing back then. And because I kind of talked him through it, and because I seemed to know what I was talking about, he put me in charge of his DVD, you know, content and films and things. So anyway, long story short, because I was a mega Blade Runner fan and because I had been put in this position of originally supervising, but then actually producing the content and in some cases the new cuts of the films of his, and again, Blade Runner being my favorite film, I was pushing for that from the very beginning and just waiting for the opportunity.
Sorry. You know? I didn't want to cut you off. I would advise our listeners to check out the special features on the Alien Quadrilogy set. Obviously, Alien and Aliens are films very near and dear to my heart. And Charles's work on Alien 3 has given me a brand new appreciation of the film. Obviously, it's still a flawed film for many reasons, but it's a lot more watchable now, sir. And I'm impressed that you and your team were able to put that together. And I love the Blade Runner set. Why don't, if you would, just throw out a plug for some of your other DVD sets that are award-winning, absolute, like, film school in a box type Blu-ray releases. They're amazing.
Well, I mean, just to clarify, I'm really going to push for the Alien Anthology Blu-ray set, which is vastly superior to the Quadrilogy DVD set. Just, you know, you gotta pay attention to these names, because otherwise you might buy it and then realize you got screwed.
Right, especially a hardcore fan like me. I should know better.
But yeah, the Alien Anthology Blu-ray set, I think, is really you know, I don't know how much better we could have made it. It was really a dream come true to work on that one.
Did you happen? You know what? I got to ask you, since you've done so much research into Alien, what did you think of the recent documentary called Memory?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, I think you'd be, it's because it doesn't just go in, it covers some, you know, well-known lore about the Alien production, but it also digs a lot into like the artistic side and the creative side that the technical Blu-ray DVD production might not. And it's a good compliment to your work in on the Alien set. It's just so much fun to dig through.
Well, I mean, I heard they used quite a bit of my interview footage. Yeah. So you know, I'll get to it one day. You know, it's fine. Yeah, but I kind of feel like I've done my time with Alien, and I love the film dearly, and I mean, you know, I love the whole series in varying levels of love, but I kind of want to explore other movies, another world.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, no matter how much you love a movie, you know, there's only so much you could take before you're like, all right, what else is out there? I think I've pretty much exhausted everything we can do. So when you're given, you know, you're finishing the Alien set and you know that the Blade Runner set is on the horizon, are you literally just feeling like a kid in a candy store? Like, am I going to be able to find this? Am I going to be able to incorporate that?
There's certainly a part of that. I mean, for me, it's more the responsibility to make sure that the film is given the absolute best you know, treatment it can get. And when I say the film, I mean the actual picture and sound of the film, and then also whatever supplemental content we put together that serves to preserve and clarify the legacy of the film, and making Ridley happy and making the fans happy, you know? And since I'm a fan, I'm a big, big fan of the film, I feel like, well, if I make myself happy, I think I'll make most of the fans happy. And to that end, you know, it was, let's put all five versions of the film in a box set so that no matter which version of the film you prefer, it's there. And it's not just there as like a rough bit of like scrap from the table. It's like we did state-of-the-art transfers, you know, for all those versions, even the work print, which is a beat up, you know, print that looks like it's been dragged behind a truck for, you know, 20 miles. Even that we put work into to try to make it as the picture and sound as best as it could be. So
It's a revelation. The final cut is presently on Netflix. I also have the Blu-ray, and it is so beautiful. The production design, the cinematography pops. Like, I mean, those composite lines are all gone. There's so much in it, and you can just, your eyes can soak in all these wonderful, like just the exposition shots before we even cut to action or talking. Just beautiful visuals, and I'm just, the final cut brought me, when we're in Sebastian's apartment, there are details on the left and right hand of the frame that I had never seen before. They all were kind of covered in haze and mist, right? And now they pop, all the little toys and stuffed animals and his furniture and the depth of the frame. You know, you could see all the way to the back of the room. It's almost 3D. It's so gorgeous.
Well, I got to tell you, one of the biggest revelations for me during the whole restoration process was when the original film elements were being scanned for us to work with, a lot of the 70 millimeter or 65 millimeter visual effects the original pristine elements were scanned, and they were scanned at 6 and 8K in some cases. And now keep in mind, this was back in like 2005, 2006, you know, like imagine, you know, 14 years ago or whatever, scanning stuff at like 8K and then seeing it, it was mind blowing. You know, I mean, it was like there were shots of like the approach to the Tyrell pyramid and all like those kind of antennas and bits of filigree that are on the top of the structure were like razor sharp in a way that I had never seen before. And you know, that to me was when I realized, oh, we're actually working on something not just cool, but actually really important for the restoration and the future history of this movie.
Yeah, I know a lot of times the restoration is, all right, we made a very pretty film look slightly prettier, but this really is scrubbing the details and finding the beauty of those shots. It is to overuse a word we've used a lot, it's a revelation. It's a movie I have so much fun revisiting because I love film noir and I love science fiction, and I know some people think Blade Runner is slow. I don't. I think it moves. I mean, it's dialogue based, yeah, but I think it moves quick. I think it moves, you know, before it's over, before I know it. And I had so much fun revisiting it for this episode. I was hoping you could briefly give our listeners just a cursory explanation on the differences, the main differences between the final cut, the director's cut, and let's say the theatrical cut?
Well, I mean, sometimes I read comments online where people are like, the difference between the director's cut and the international cut is minimal. And it's like, well, that's probably true. And then they'll say, oh, and the differences between the director's cut and the final cut are also minimal, to which I say, bullshit. There's like 100 picture changes between the director's cut, between any of the other cuts, and the final cut. And a lot of those are visual effects enhancements. A lot of those are minor trims.
My compliments on the, I forget the character name, but Joanna Cassidy's character when she goes,
Zora, when she goes
through the panes of glass. And I love this film. This is not a knock, but when I saw it on network television, when I saw it on VHS, DVD, you could tell that's not Joanna Cassidy. It's just clear as day. And it's seamless now. It's beautiful. So,
well, I mean, that was, thank you, first of all, but that was like a big philosophical discussion we had, because I don't believe that when you go back into a film, especially one that's like, you know, like a cinematic Mona Lisa, the way Blade Runner is, I don't believe you should go back in there and start adding stuff just to make it cooler or to make it more futuristic or to say, oh, here's something that we couldn't do back in 82, we're going to do now. For me, it's about removing problems and flaws that take you out of the film. You know, so the Zora scene, even when I was like 15 years old, seeing it in the theater for the first time, you know, I didn't laugh, but there was laughter in the theater. When the stunt double with the bad wig comes through the glass, you know, it's like, it's kind of like that bit in the Naked Gun when Ricardo Montalban yanks that bad dummy of Priscilla Presley down the baseball stadium. It's like, it was really, really obviously a stunt double and a bad wig. And it took people out of the film. And you've got this beautiful emotional moment that's being hit with, you know, her tragic murder, basically, and the incredible music. And it's a long lens shot. It's very languid and slow-mo. So you have time to scrutinize it, and you're scrutinizing a stunt double and a wig. So that was like number one item that we had to address. And I mentioned to Warner Brothers, you know, politely, of course, but I said, look, if we can't pull this off, if we're just going to make it as good or even worse, we shouldn't do it. I mean, we can shoot it and we can try it, but if it's not going to succeed, it's only going to make it, it's going to be like a new flaw, basically. So, you know, fortunately, Warner's was very generous, and, you know, we had a really great team. John Sheely, who's the visual effects supervisor for the final cut, he brought in a lot of different companies, and we ended up working with New Deal Studios and Sony Image Works, and went down with Joanna Cassidy 25 years after the fact. And she, you know, still looks amazing to this day. And she went down, and this time with a great wig and even the snake tattoo that's down the side of her face. And she even had the original costume, and she brought that back. And so in front of a green screen, she just kind of sat in a chair and mimicked the body movement that's in the shot. And then the effects team, you know, very seamlessly, you know, put her into the shot. And it was fascinating to watch, because at any moment it could have gone bad, and they managed to just really create the magic of that was really, you know, quote unquote, really Joanna Cassidy back in 1982 doing that scene.
Yeah. It's fascinating, because if you just watching Blade Runner in the final cut, say first time, nothing in there is going to stand out as, oh my God, they reshot this 30 years later and it sure looks like it. No, it's very subtle. But if you know that, you know, that pronounced wig and the stunt woman did not have the same body build, and it just kind of sucked you out of a really effective death scene / special effects moment, because that stunt woman must have gone through hell to shoot that. Good Lord. But yeah, I mean, like you said, it's not adding little bells and whistles. This was kind of clunky. It's the best way it could have done in 82, and now we're going to do some surgery. And it's that to me is the difference between that and, no disrespect, but like, the Star Wars special editions, which is let's add some extra junk, you know, which I'm not a big fan of. I know some people like them, but I'm not.
Well, that was my concern with the Star Wars special editions was, and I'm a mega Star Wars nerd. Okay. So I go in, I actually went to a test screening of the Star Wars special edition before it actually came out in theaters. And so we were like the first audience of Star Wars fans to see the special edition that we'd heard about. And immediately the problem is, because the changes are so big and obvious and colorful, and, you know, it was kind of like they wanted to just go back and reshoot chunks of the film in ways that were more exciting and bigger. The problem is, as a fan, you stop and you start to assess each one of these changes, and then suddenly you're out of the movie. And I think it's easy to say that, okay, well, we've all seen Star Wars 100 times, so it's okay to like stop and be critical, or to, you know, kind of like critique what these new changes are. But to me, it was like, well, I'm no longer in the movie. I am now judging new effect shots. So with Blade Runner, I wanted to do the opposite. I wanted us to kind of forget that there were changes being made, you know, so they were very clean and elegant and integrated into the film in ways that, you know, seemed like it was always there. Like that.
I'm sorry, I did to talk about the Zora scene, which is absolutely fascinating. I cut you off a little bit. So you were just explaining like the major differences, like what if you were well, obviously you produced the final cut. So, and we've already talked about this on Twitter, and that is your favorite cut. It is mine as well. I think it's the most complete and thorough cut, and what was close to what Ridley Scott originally intended. But let's talk about how you got to that point, like with the major differences and what, if you had to recommend, say, the international cut or the director's cut for an asset or two, what would they be?
To be honest, I wouldn't recommend the director's cut at all, just because it's kind of a half measure, and I think it's only there if you've seen the other versions and out of kind of a curiosity, I guess you would want to maybe check it out. The international cut is interesting because that's sort of close to the original theatrical cut that people first saw, but it's got a little bits of extra violence in it. So it's kind of like the slightly, you know, unrated, naughty version of what we all saw in 1982. And I think that's a valuable version for that reason. But then I think the work print is actually fascinating. I think that is a fascinating alternate cut of the film that I think that once you've seen the final cut, and then maybe you've sampled, you know, the others, I definitely highly recommend the work print. And then I got to say, there's one other, you know, alternate version, which is basically the deleted and alternate scenes, which I am extremely proud of. And I had so much fun putting together because, you know, we want to include deleted scenes. And we had found a few during the process of, you know, sort of like researching what the final cut was going to be. We had found little trims and little odd little deleted scenes like Deckard visiting.
I gotta ask you that because deleted scenes it just fascinate any movie geek, geek, right? So, did you ever come across like two or three small deleted scenes where you're like, Ridley, gotta get this back in the movie? And he's like, nah, mate, nope. And you're like, why not?
No, actually, no. I completely understood why the deleted scenes were cut out of the film. But I'll just say that, you know, there were certain deleted scenes that we had found, like for instance when Deckard visits Holden at the hospital, there were two of those. I had only seen one previously. We found a second one, which is really fascinating to see. But what really drove the deleted scenes was all of this alternate voiceover that Harrison Ford had recorded. And this is voiceover that is not the one we heard in the US theatrical or international cuts back in 82. This was what they recorded before they recorded that version. And it was very, very different. I mean, you hear a tiny snippet of it at the end of the work print, but it's completely different tone, different writing style, different performance. So I found, you know, we found that, and then we found the deleted scenes. And then I was trying to think of a way to keep those alternate bits of voiceover alive. So since we're going through all the negative anyway for the final cut, I started thinking, well, there are all these alternate takes and angles and just bits of weird extensions of shots that we're not going to see otherwise. So I thought, let's take all this and cut it together into what's basically a 47-minute alternate universe version of the film. And that to me is in many ways my favorite version, just because it's so unusual and different and kind of gets under the skin of Blade Runner in a way that the other cuts don't, because it's from an alternate perspective. So I would highly recommend that as well.
And it's a lot more interesting than just saying, all right, here's 40 minutes of deleted scenes broken up by, you know, a leader click. There you go. It's kind of like an interesting little narrative trick. And that's on the Blu-ray as well. And before we let you go, I'll talk a little bit about Dangerous Days. And man, wow, what an epic documentary. It's like it could have been half that size, half that length and half that scope, and I still would have been impressed. It's like a good 2.5 hours, covers everything you'd want to know about the movie, and still leaves you wanting more. I mean, talk it's like one of your career highlights so far, right?
Yeah, and also, by the way, it's actually more like 3.5 hours.
Thank you.
And it's, you know, look, it's 3.5 hours. And then on one of the other discs, we have even more featurettes that are kind of supplemental to the documentary. So, look, we all told, we interviewed about 80 people for the whole thing. And it was just, to me, it was endlessly fascinating to hear these stories straight from the mouths of the people who were there, you know. And what was really interesting was that I never thought we'd get Harrison Ford, but he was, out of the 80 interviews, he was number two. We got wow. him so early on, because we were about to lose him to Crystal Skull, I believe. And I was thinking, man, if I wait till later to get him and we don't get him because he gets busy again, I just didn't want to live with that idea that we could have had him and we passed because we wanted to wait till later. So we jumped on it, and he was great. And I mean, he did his best to kind of dig up the memories and be honest about it. And that was definitely the only time I've ever been purely starstruck conducting an interview. I was kind of just like, you know, blown away just by the fact I'm sitting across from Indy and Han and Jack Ryan and Rick Deckard, all like wrapped up into one person. So,
John Book,
definitely love John Book,
the Frisco Kid.
Yeah,
Charles, thank you so much for joining in on the podcast. Of course, you joined in on it for 80s All Over, and when I have a third podcast, we will invite you again. As a sign off, I want you to tell our listeners, who's your favorite character in Blade Runner and why?
My favorite character in Blade Runner has to be Batty. I think that's probably a lot of people's favorite character, because, you know, he's presented as the villain, but he's really the hero. You know, he's fighting for his family. He's fighting for freedom. He's fighting for life. He's basically, you know, he's doing whatever he can to protect his own. And he's kind of a noble warrior who's been cast into a world that he didn't ask to be cast into, you know? So like, that to me is interesting. Whereas Deckard, who's ostensibly the hero, has chosen to be kind of like a garbage person, you know, to go and kind of kill people. And if you watch the film, you know, Deckard only kills like the two women in the film. So he's kind of a coward. He's kind of like just not a great hero. But part of Batty's, you know, beauty is that he, in the end, I think helps Deckard rediscover his humanity. So that's why I love Batty.
Yeah, I love Batty too. And you nailed it at the end. He does the most human act in the whole film. He wanted Deckard to feel the fear that he felt, and he did. And then he let him live. And that was for a replicant, that's a pretty humane thing to do. My favorite character is, of course, J.F. Sebastian, because I think he is the sad and dying heart of humanity in this kind of cold and clinical, but wonderfully beautiful movie. And again, thank you, Charles, for signing. I'm sorry. We have to make an edit now. Damn. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.